Blog Talk Radio.
You may not be paid for the job.
And some of you will be
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Red Fox Blogger with your hosts Tim Burton and Cal Fritzy. Today we're going to be discussing quite a few things. Before we even get into the topic at hand, though, I have a letter I want to relate to you from Ezra Levant. I'll explain who he is in a moment for those who don't know, but before I even do that, I would like to say hello to my fellow host. And, oops, you know what? It would help if I brought him on, wouldn't it? Hi, Tim.
Well, good evening, Kellen. How the devil are you tonight?
I am infidelity fine. What about you?
Oh, I'm good too. I was going to say, shall I say I'm unbelievably well, or shall I offer you my most earnest contrafibularities? And I thought, no, I'm not going to get into that again.
Quit sending me into connections.
Yes, I am anaspeptic, phrasmotic, and even compunctious to have caused you such pericombobulations. But there we go.
I'm already discombobulated.
All right, that's enough of that then. And there's still a prize on offer for the first person who can tell me where that quotation came from, because it is a quotation. It's one I'm quite fond of, and if anybody can tell me before the end of the show, you win points. And you know what points mean, don't you, Kel? Points mean
oh, you know what?
Prizes.
We have prizes. We do. We have prizes. So if you can figure out where Tim is quoting that from, call in. And even better, if you call in, get it right, and maybe donate a little money to Tim's defense fund. You just might end up with a really nice prize.
Yes, very good. There's a link for that somewhere. I'll see if I can find that.
I have it right in the show notes.
Lovely.
There you go. Yep, even for the archive listeners, Tim's links are all right there, and you can free the Birmingham one, and the link is there as well. But before we get started, Tim, I got a letter here in my email this morning, and this is something that you can certainly relate to. I think everybody is pretty much familiar with Ezra Levant. He is the publisher of the now defunct Western Standard, which went belly up, I guess, because he was sued by a group of Muslims. They did not like him publishing the Danish cartoons. He is the one of the hosts at Sun News Network, and he has also written numerous books, including Shakedown, and that was his experiences with the Canadian Human Rights Tribunals. Well, once again, Ezra Levant is being taken to court, this time, though, not with the Human Rights Tribunal, but with an actual courtroom, so he may prevail. He prevailed with the Human Rights Tribunal, but it cost him a fortune. It cost him quite a bit of money to beat that one. But this is what I got in my email, Tim. Dear Kelly,
okay.
Oh, I like that. After two delays, my week-long free speech trial finally starts tomorrow. And I said today, but when I was speaking with Tim, but I do remember Ezra Levant saying March 4th. So yes, it starts tomorrow. You were kind enough to contribute to my legal defense fund. Thanks to you, I feel like I'm well-equipped with an excellent lawyer. I appreciate that. You may remember that the person suing me is Karim Awan. He's the former youth leader of the Canadian Islamic Congress, the same guy who went after Mark Stein at the BC Human Rights Tribunal. In fact, he's suing me for my critical comments about him at Stein's trial. So this is the next battle in that same war. The trial is expected to go till Friday. If you're in the Toronto area this week, I'd love it if you could stop by the courthouse. That is on the 7th floor at 393 University Avenue. I hear Mark Stein might even be there himself. I wanted to tell you, your contribution just didn't help me financially. It's an enormous morale boost as well. To know that so many Canadians care about freedom of speech and want me to stand up confidence. The whole point of Islamic lawfare is to exhaust their target. In fact, even though Mark Stein technically won his case in BC, Awan still boasted afterwards that we attained our strategic objective to increase the cost of publishing anti-Islamic material. He admits that lawfare is his official strategy, so I'm glad you've helped cover my costs. Since this lawsuit deals with events that happened before I joined the Sun News Network, the Sun's lawyers aren't helping me. I'm on my own, but you've made sure I'm not alone. If you can't come to the courthouse, you can still keep up with the trial on my website at standwithezra.ca. We'll give you a brief daily update and post links to any press coverage. Thanks again for your help. And if you know anyone else who might want to join in our fight for freedom, please ask them to join us and visit this website, standwithezra.ca. Yours gratefully, Ezra Levant. P.S. Thanks again. Now let's go win this thing. There you go.
Very good. Yeah, that's excellent. Well, yes, I mean, it's going to become all too common. I mean, Ezra Levant, he's quite a high-profile critic of Islam. And, of course, when people like this take out these lawsuits, it doesn't cost them anything at all, or at least if there's a cost, it's paid for by the very deep pockets of Islamic interests, where, of course, anybody who's fighting in the counter jihad, like you or I or Ezra, has to pay everything out of their own pocket. And even if they may win the suit, there's still a price to be paid in terms of legal costs. And it is, as you say, it's just lawfare to make the cost of criticizing Islam that much more high. But we have to do it. We have to do it, because if we cannot criticize Islam, then it will steamroller all over our civilization, our traditions and values, and life for everybody on the planet will be that much poorer as a result. So we have to do it no matter what the cost.
Well, I think, too, in exposing their tactics, we expose them for what they are, whiny, complaining, embittered, and an absolute pain in the backside, and the public will not stand for it. If we expose these cases and get it out there in the general populace, if we can get people to read these stories and go, what on earth is this? What? You mean I can't say anything critical? This is what I'm being told. And people will get to the point where they just won't stand for it any longer, Tim. So they're exposing themselves.
Yeah. Indeed, it is a question of getting enough people aware of the issues that are involved, because if people really understood what was at stake, then you're absolutely right, Kel, they would not stand for it. At the moment, there's a lot of people out there who either don't understand what's at stake or think that there are other important things they should be giving their attention to, and we have to make them see that there is no more important task than waking people up to the evils of Islam and what it might do if it gains the upper hand and takes over and destroys our civilization and our way of life. Because make no mistake, ladies and gentlemen, that is exactly what it will do. There's no sense of coexistence or negotiation or compromise with Islam. When it feels strong enough, or when Muslims feel that they are strong enough to implement Islam in every respect, then that is what they will do. And it will be to the detriment of humanity as a whole. Largely for non-Muslims, of course, who will belatedly realise how precious freedom was as they find they're being crushed under the Islamic jackboot, but also for Muslims themselves, who are being led by the nose down a dead-end path, which has absolutely no value for humanity at all, whatsoever. And so it is so important that we win this fight, and it is going to have a cost. It's having a cost that people like Ezra Levant and myself are paying for now, but it will have a cost for everybody if we let Islam prevail in any way and let it gain a greater foothold than it already has.
Mm-hmm. Well, they like those big juicy targets like Ezra Levant and Mark Stein, but they're not stopping there. They're not stopping at the big targets. They're going after people who otherwise nobody would ever hear of, people like Kat Stringer 101. Like they're ruthless.
Well, indeed. I mean, the thing about, in the UK, people like Tell Mama don't actually have to do a great deal themselves. It hasn't cost, for example, it hasn't cost Tell Mama a penny, really, for the guy
That's
at
great.
The top, the mendacious grievance monger in chief, to trot down to his local police station and register a complaint against me. And they are the police and the criminal justice system are just only too willing to jump through hoops for these people and persecute me for things that I have said and written. Even though they are, I mean, I've been charged with harassment, as you know, and not just ordinary harassment, ladies and gentlemen. This is racially aggravated harassment. This is super-duper harassment in the British legal justice system, and it means any penalties are increased by, well, they're increased substantially if there's a racial element involved. Now, apart from the fact that Islam is not a race, the fact is that 50 years ago, when I was growing up, if somebody said something nasty to somebody else that was offensive, then we stopped there because we had a different outlook on being offended then, and we would brush it off. And I'm still offended every day by what I see going on around the world with Muslims slaughtering their way around the world in the name of Islam. 22,500 fatal attacks since 9/11, all by Muslims in the name of Islam. So, I'm offended. Who addresses my sense of offence? Well, nobody, and I don't expect them
to
because I'm a grown-up. But these people, it costs them nothing. They kick the justice system into action, and police officers trot round and arrest all and sundry, and the courts at the moment seem only too happy to oblige these Islamo-fascists by convicting everybody that comes up before them, no matter what the argument. Well, I suspect that people like Mark Stein and Ezra Levant, and I certainly intend to do the same, I expect that they will put up a good fight, and I certainly intend to fight with everything I have at my disposal. But when you're up against politically correct, multicultural magistrates and judges and other bodies of that sort, you know, it can be an uphill struggle. And I would not for one moment put money on any of these cases being a foregone conclusion, even though, you know, based on common sense, any reasonable person would look at the circumstances and throw the cases out of court. But of course, we're not dealing with reasonable people. We are dealing with the product of 40 years of political correctness and multiculturalism, which means that the people who are now in these influential positions, I mean, judges and magistrates and so on, are infected with the political correctness to the point that they cannot see common sense if it came up to them in the street and slapped them across the face with a wet kipper.
Well, we've always came to the conclusion pretty much that it is a groupthink with this particular entity, and that they're not capable of autonomy, individual autonomy, and taking responsibility for their own feelings and for their own actions. They run with the groupthink, and that is another issue with Islam that we have to deal with. That would probably be a great topic for another time, because believe me, Islam is the gift that keeps on giving. But this topic though that we're dealing with today, the Hofstad group, is it's quite dense, it's quite fascinating, and it's quite interesting. But can you hear my phone ringing?
I can't, Kel, but my ears are not what they were, so I'll take your word for it.
Oh, here, hang on. I'm gonna move it to voicemail. Hang on a sec. Sorry, guys.
Hello, infidel. Infidel, phone ringing. Oh yes, infidel. Pick up the phone. It could be Allah calling. Oh, pick up the phone before it blows up.
Oh, those telemarketers from the Middle East, I tell you.
Oh, Kel, that's so funny.
And that's actually courtesy of Tim, so there you go. Oh, boy. Oh, yep, it's bad enough. We get the telemarketers from India. Now we're getting them from the Middle East. What are we to do, Tim? I'm telling you.
Yes, I know.
But this topic, the Hofstad group, my apologies, It piqued my interest because we were talking about Theo Van Gogh, or Van Gogh, as it's pronounced in the UK. I looked this up, Tim, by the way, as a quick sidebar.
Uh-huh.
In North America, the pronunciation is Van Gogh. In the UK, it is Van Gogh. So we both win prizes there, Tim.
Excellent. I like a win-win situation. Okay, that's good news.
One thing that, this really piqued my interest because we were talking about Theo Van Gogh and Mohamed Bouyeri, who slaughtered him in the streets. That was in,
I think that was 2004, wasn't it?
And we briefly touched upon that when we were covering another topic, and I thought, well, what is this Hofstadt group? I'm rather interested by this. So I came across this PDF file, and the Hofstadt group, it's an Islamic terrorist organization of 9 young Muslims in the Netherlands. The name Hofstadt was originally the code name of the Dutch General Intelligence and Security Services. That's what they used for the group, which leaked to the media in 2003. The name refers to a popular name for the city of The Hague, where some members have been active. The group was influenced by the ideology of Takfir al-Hijra, a violent Islamic organization, and I do believe that's out of Egypt. Now, one of the Hofstadt group's key members is Mohamed Bouyeri, the man responsible for the murder of controversial, and I don't like that word, but it's in here, Dutch writer and filmmaker Theo Van Gogh in November of 2004. Yeah. Bouyeri was convicted in July of 2005 for planning and carrying out the attack. 13 other suspects were taken into custody on various charges in connection with the murder. 9 of the total 14 suspects were convicted for membership of a terrorist organization and are currently serving various sentences ranging from 1 year to life imprisonment. Now, they have this study of the Hofstadt group. They're only going to consider the 9 topic. The 9 subjects. But I thought, Tim, that it only was restricted to 9 people. It would appear that they knew of at least 14. I'm wondering if there's even more out there that they're not aware of. Now, the Hofstadt group in focus in 2002, Tim. The Hofstadt group emerged from a diffuse and self-generated autonomous network of about 20. Young radical Muslims who met each other to discuss political and religious issues. This network did not have fixed boundaries as its composition changed over time. Now, I'm not going to read that too much verbatim, but this is what I mean. I thought when I initially looked up the Hofstadt group that there were only a small handful of them running around creating mayhem, but it seems that this organization is bigger than we think.
Well, yes, and the trouble with what the Dutch have described as autonomous networks is that because of the ideology that drives it, which of course is Islamic ideology, that autonomous networks, in quotation marks, are likely to spring up pretty much anywhere, because if you look at what the security services are having to deal with, not only in Holland, but in every country in Western Europe where you're getting an increasing population of Muslims, the radicalization that is appearing, especially in the younger generation, is such that you're going to see a lot of similarities between autonomous networks, in quotation marks, pretty much everywhere. And although this particular group was in focus in the Netherlands about 10 years ago, and in particular since the murder of Theo Van Gogh, the broader problem seems to have been completely missed by the Dutch authorities, which is to say they've identified a group of between 9 and 20 young radical Muslims, and it's almost as if the authorities said to themselves, here's a group of between 9 and 20 Muslims that for no apparent reason have become radicalized. So let's see if we can round them all up, and maybe if we sort of raid their houses, we can find out who their friends are and so on, and maybe round up as many as we can and lock those people away if they are found to have transgressed the criminal law. And it appears that they've totally missed the point about the Islamic ideology that is the driving factor behind this, not only this network, but pretty much every other network that has developed since, well, 2002, which is when they reckon that this group actually emerged. And it's something that in the intervening 10 or 12 years, political elites everywhere just do not want to seem to touch this issue, even though at some point it absolutely must be confronted. The fact that these are not just springing out of nowhere, but they are driven by the Islamic ideology. And the reason they're driven by the Islamic ideology is because Islam has a mandated doctrine of warfare against unbelievers, and that is eternal, valid for all times and all places. And until we recognize this very unpleasant fact as a matter of fact rather than something to be suppressed and kept down and kept out of the public view, we're going to have a great deal of difficulty keeping tabs on all these autonomous networks that keep springing up out of nowhere.
One person of interest, of course, is Mohamed Bouyeri. And when he joined this organization, when he became radicalized, that there were many who were surprised, because during his childhood, he seemed rather benign and peaceful. He was born in Amsterdam in 1978 as a child of immigrant parents of Moroccan Berber heritage. Now, he grew up in a low-income immigrant neighborhood in the west of Amsterdam, but in elementary school, Bouyeri was an exemplary student. He was extremely bright and was able to advance to higher general secondary education in the 1990s. In 1995, Bouyeri received his diploma. One of his teachers even praised him as one of the bright boys who would probably succeed. Now, Bouyeri, he seemed to have a sense of compassion. He wanted to help his peers to achieve more in Dutch society. Although he did not have many friends and was kind of shy around girls, but at college he switched his studies a number of times. A bright man who seems rootless. Where have we seen that scenario before, eh, Tim? But he started getting himself in trouble. Yeah, he started getting in trouble. His first encounter with, pardon me, with the police happened in 1997 when he was involved in a fist fight with a police officer. I don't know if this contributed to his disenfranchisement with the Dutch society, and that he was turned himself in. And well, he already seemed like a misfit. He had few friends and was shy around girls. So, you know, there you go. He was probably a nerd. On the outskirts of a social, outskirts of the social hub, we see a lot of that. But he was getting himself in trouble with the law and becoming increasingly disenfranchised. So perhaps this is what led up to his phase of radicalization, and this was quite a process. And this is before he killed Theo Van Gogh around the summer of 2004. He believed to have encountered some misfortune in relation to girls. His reputation as the scholar of the network, sitting behind his personal computer most of the time, was not regarded as high or that as a true jihadi with plans to travel to places such as Chechnya or Iraq, or who would be willing to take concrete action in the Netherlands. So, yeah, he started around the spring of 2004 and then escalated to what we saw in November of 2004 with the murder of Theo Van Gogh.
Yes, and reading through that, of course, it's very surprising that the authorities, being as willfully blind as they are, haven't gone out of their way to develop a program for incarcerating everybody who's ever had trouble with girls when they were growing up. You know, because that's obviously what's caused him to turn into one of the bad guys. You know, the fact that he's had all this trouble in his personal life. Well, hey, you know, why not just ban girls? You know, or why not just make it a criminal offence not to report a failed relationship when you're growing up as a teenager? Because that's obviously where they think that they need to be focusing their actions. I mean, the fact is that people encounter all sorts of problems as they're growing up, and what's being described here is not actually so very difficult. I mean, you could pretty much take any teenager at some point in their growing up process, and they'll have had some difficulty in personal relationships. It's not as if it's an uncommon thing, but the authorities seem to have placed undue emphasis on it, when really what they should have been doing is saying, well, okay, there are going to be people who are vulnerable at various times in their lives, and you could possibly say that when it comes to teenagers who are unhappy in their relationships, pretty much every teenager is going to reach a point like that sometime in their life where they're going to feel rather down and vulnerable and open to all sorts of suggestions if they've had a bad experience. I mean, I wouldn't like to say that there was any time in my life when, because I'd been rejected, I felt like, you know, picking up a knife or a gun and going out and shooting somebody, because I didn't. Now, that I might just be out of the ordinary for as far as the Dutch authorities are concerned, but they would rather focus on that than focus on the fact that when people are vulnerable at various times in their life, then they're open to all sorts of malignant influences, such as Islam.
Yeah,
and I think
who wants to know that it would lead to such radicalization? I mean, of course, I mean, everybody's had their you know, their stories about rejection in the realm of romance. I mean, we've all been down that road, but I never felt compelled to join a terrorist cell and engage in jihad. But that, you're right, Tim, is that, oh, okay, he's just a confused young lad and what to do with him and this and that. But his wiring, I've always felt the wiring of a Muslim is vastly different from that of the rest of the populace.
Well,
in that,
yeah, I'd agree with that. And the reason I would agree with that is that when they are growing up, they are taught characteristics which are completely at odds with what we teach our children in our Judeo-Christian civilization, with our traditions and values. Mm-hmm. Well, there are too many to mention, really, but it stems from the fact that the morality and the ethics of Islam are completely the inverse of the morality and ethics of our Judeo-Christian traditions, completely the inverse. So that when you look at what, I mean, for example, one of the first things we're taught when we're growing up is the difference between good and evil. And our parents, if they're good parents, give us examples of this all the time. And if we go to school and we're taught lessons in morality during our religious education classes, one of the first things we're taught is how important it is to distinguish between good and evil. At least that was the case when I was growing up, in this politically correct multicultural atmosphere of cultural relativism. I'm not sure how relevant that is today, but it ought to be. And if you cannot distinguish between good and evil, then you're in trouble right from the start when you go mm-hmm. out into the wider world. But of course, with Islam, there is no external reference of good and evil. The only thing that is good in Islam is what promotes Islam. And if there is something that is an obstacle to the spread of Islam, or something that prevents Islam from expanding in the way that Muslims would like to see, then that is bad. And that is the only reference of good and bad that Muslims have. There is no external mm-hmm. reference of good and evil like we have in our Judeo-Christian tradition. And that is why Muslims grow up behaving the way they do, which seems completely at odds with the rest of us. And it is completely at odds with the rest of us because of this fundamental difference between the concepts of good and evil. So once you understand that, then you can start to see why it is that Muslims behave the way they do. And in fact, it's quite surprising that more Muslims don't behave in that way, given that the fundamental concepts of good and evil are so completely different.
This Hofstede group network, it was classified as a diffuse and self-generated autonomous network, in that the Hofstede group was not organized in a top-down command structure, although they did have spiritual support and guidance from outside the country. Okay, this support was personified in Radun al-Assar, also known as the Syrian. The external support did not appear to come from any international groups, even though some in the mainstream media tried to point a finger to al-Qaeda. Even some scholars saw a connection. Paul Wilkinson, one of Europe's leading scholars on terrorism, for instance, cited the link between the Netherlands Hostef group and al-Qaeda. He regarded the soft link of the group as an interesting example of al-Qaeda's small but determined presence within Europe. Okay, Tim, boy. So they essentially what they were doing is that they were seeing this, but they were still ignoring it. That's the impression that I'm getting, is that it brings us back full circle in that the governments, they know what's going on. They see the writing on the wall. They see the signs, but they're not doing anything about it. I don't understand why that is.
Well, the most obvious explanation to me, and when I'm looking for explanations, I always try and think of what is most likely, because for any given set of circumstances, there may be at any one time two or three possible answers, but there's usually one that stands out and as the most likely. And if you focus on that one, more often than not, you will find that that is the true thing. I mean, with this particular example, the authorities have tried to link what was effectively a small group of between 9 and 20 Dutch Muslims in the Hofstad group and al-Qaeda, which is considered to be the terrorist wing that is a complete distortion of Islamic values, as all our political elites will tell us. And they're trying to completely whitewash over the fact that Islamic doctrine is the driving force behind everything that we're seeing. Now, they're taking this view because if they were to come out and say, yeah, everything that the counter-jihadists have been saying is correct, the Islamic doctrine is the driving force behind all the evil acts that we have seen in recent history, and the reason that it's the driving force is because Islam has a doctrine which mandates warfare, eternal warfare, against the non-believer, and that devout Muslims are commanded to expand Islam and overcome obstacles to Islam at whatever cost, and the methods they may use can include fear, terror, violence, intimidation. That is not a problem for a devout Muslim, because if the goal is to advance Islam, then it is permissible. And when you're talking about permissible goals, of course, you've also got another very important fact here, which is that Muslims have raised the art of deception to an art form. And deceit, the Prophet Muhammad himself said, war is deceit, and what Muslims take from that is that it is permissible to lie and to deceive non-Muslims in the pursuit of expanding Islam so that it becomes victorious worldwide. Now, all these have got tremendous implications. If they were recognized by the general public, we talked in the past about the various aspects of Islamic deceit with Taqiyya, Tawriyya, Maruna and Kitman. I won't go into them in details again, but they're all aspects of lying and deceit which come as naturally to Muslims as breathing, and is another reason why we have so much trouble with Muslims in our society, which is built on trust and goodwill between people that we meet in everyday circumstances. But if you apply those general rules of trust to Muslims, you will come unstuck, because their modus operandi is to lie to and to deceive non-Muslims so that Islam will become victorious in whatever small way that might be. So yes, the authorities do not want, this is a particular example, but generally speaking, the authorities in Western societies do not want this to become known. They do not want the general public to make a connection between the evil that Muslims do and the doctrine within Islam that mandates warfare against non-believers on an eternal basis for all times and all places. They do not that want that to become public knowledge, because if it were to become public knowledge, then the authorities would have no alternative but to do something about it, and they really don't want to do anything about it. So that's the reason behind that. In my view, that is the most likely reason, and I haven't seen anything to contradict that theory since I started looking into this some years ago. So that's my view on it. Other people may have other ideas, but I feel that's far and away the most likely explanation.
That just does not sit well with me at all, because it would seem the Halstead Group had been under surveillance and that they put together this paper. The general public, of course, only became aware of the Halstead Group after the murder of Theo van Gogh. What really bothers me, though, is the methods and tactics, and that the methods and tactics of the Halstead Group are difficult to distinguish because the group lacked a coherent strategy, and most of the crimes were committed by individual members. See, they are so, like the lack of cohesion and a lack of a coherent strategy. When you are involved in an organization that is so disjointed, how are the authorities, I understand, how are the authorities to actually connect all the dots? But there were underlying events taking place that could tie these individuals back to one common denominator, and the umbrella being that of the Halstead Group. Why is it that after Theo van Gogh was murdered and the general public started becoming aware of the Halstead Group, that the government seemed determined to take a further action with them, i.e. they did, in the end, classify them as a terrorist organization? But it took the murder of Theo van Gogh to get to that point. That's my impression of this, and this is the lack of action on the part of the politicians. Now, every government has a wing within their organization which studies the issue of terrorism. For goodness sake, 9/11, 9/11 in 2001. This individual murdered Theo van Gogh in 2004. By then, there should have been precautions put in place to be prepared for this sort of behaviorisms within the West, but it is still going on. How many years past 9/11 are we? And it still seems that we do not have ourselves a coherent response to dealing with these individuals, nor these groups, Tim.
Well, we don't, and that's because our political elites and the mainstream media are complicit in this, of course. Our political elites prefer to deal in fantasy. They prefer to say, as in the case of the Hofstad group, that, oh, yeah, this is just a small group of people acting in a particular way, and all we need to do is to get hold of all the members of the group and their friends and family if necessary, and deal with them and not deal with the wider problem, which is the Islamic ideology and the doctrine that is driving these people to become radicalized and to perform terrorist acts in the first place. I suppose if you were going to treat a political elite as you would treat an individual, you would say that in denial, in psychological terms, they do not want to admit what the truth really is, because the truth is just so horrible and so has such far-reaching consequences that if it were true, it would completely turn their world upside down because of the things that they would have to do in order to deal with it in a sane and sensible manner. But that is where we are. We have a tremendous problem that is based on the fact that the Islamic ideology is deeply hostile to Western civilization and is going to be and has been demonstrated to be totally ruthless in its attempts to overturn it by fear, violence, terror and intimidation. Now, as I say, the authorities don't want to recognize this because it would mean taking such steps that are not politically acceptable, or they feel are not politically acceptable to the populations in the Western countries. it's a much, much wider problem than just going after 15 or 20 individual members when they uncover a terror cell like this. If you think, oh, the entire problem can be solved, or at least we can appease public opinion, even if it's only temporarily, by arresting and locking up 15 to 20 people and designating that operation as being a complete success, that earns them brownie points in a way that most people can relate to. You know, if there's a group of people involved in a criminal act, 15 or 20 people, right, that's quite a lot. But nevertheless, if you can round them all up and publicise the fact, then a lot of people can comprehend that. What people are going to find it difficult to comprehend is that a significant proportion of the population in their country are likely to be radicalized in the same way, because nobody is dealing with the fact that the Islamic ideology is behind it. Now, that's a huge mistake, because the problem can only get worse. If you had a population in Western countries of, say, 1%, before it becomes a real problem, because as we've spoken about before, when the Muslim population of a Western country is only about the 1% mark, you don't see a great deal in the way of problems. But at that point, if you recognise that the Islamic ideology is what it is, which is to say a political ideology rather than a religion, you can take the steps to deal with it in an appropriate fashion and keep it under control, so that if the population expands, you have a more effective way of dealing with it. But of course, once you get past the 1% mark, you have all sorts of additional problems that increase exponentially. And that's the short-sightedness of the political thinking of just about every political elite in all Western countries. So, to get back to your original question, you know, why aren't the authorities doing what they should be doing about it? I think it is just a question of denial. They do not want to admit to the general public in the individual countries that kind of problem actually exists, and they will do what they can to suppress it. And I've no doubt that when we speak out about these things, we are going to be demonised and marginalised as far as possible by the political elites and the mainstream media who are complicit in all this.
And this brings us to another point. And I've been taking notes here furiously. I've got my scratch pad in front of me, and I got a few things I really want to bring up, because I think these would be interesting questions to pose to the listeners as well. But before I do that, is that due to the more or less loose character of the Hofstede group and the fact that it included 9 personalities, it is difficult to distinguish the root cause and trigger causes of terrorist activities for the entire group. Now, they're certainly focusing on Mohamed Bouyeri, because that was quite a sensational murder in the Netherlands, and of course it resonated globally as well. But they focus on him in particular, and this is what they have to say: the root causes of his radicalization process and the subsequent murder can be found in 2 areas, in his personal life and in politics. In his personal life, he encountered problems that are typical for many immigrant Muslims in the Netherlands, including perceived discrimination, problems between generations, and difficulties with personal identity. Oh, wine, put on your big boy pants already. Bouyeri was aware of these problems and tried to play an active role in alleviating or eradicating them as a student, even after dropping out of college. But with regards to politics, Bouyeri, he seemed to have been particularly upset about perceived critique of Islam by politicians and public opinion makers and the foreign policies of Western countries with regard to the Muslim world. In addition, there was the availability of a radical Islamist ideology, which channeled his worries and anger and provided answers on how to deal with them. Oh boy, yeah, that one scares me. These deeper causes in combination with trigger events determined the speed and direction of his radicalization process, which culminated in his terrorist crime in November of 2004. Now, yeah, the politicians, they seem to be incapable of dealing with this. They know that there's a radicalization program up going on in their little minds there. I call it the radicalization program because I think that is what Islam is, and that's what Islam strives to do, is they program the adherents, and they're encouraged by their co-religionists. I was jotting down some notes here, and if the government or if these think tanks, these scholars or these intellectuals can see this, why is it that we are still just writing papers about it instead of taking direct action? Now, I don't know what to do in terms of dealing with Islam, the radicalized Islam. I have no idea what to do with the jihad or anything like that, short of internment camps. We're not going to see that happen. We saw what happened during World War II when we did that with the Japanese, when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor in the United States. So that is not an option. It's almost like we need to come up with a minority report, and I know that's that sounds very, very, how should I put it, quite sci-fi. But every time I read articles like this and I read these PDF files, it's kind of like we need a minority report, and I think everybody's familiar with that Tom Cruise movie, Minority Report, in which one could be arrested even before they committed a crime because it was on the assumption that they would commit a crime. Tim?
Yes, yes, indeed. And I mean that you've put your finger on the problem there, because if we got to the point where we said, well, if you're Muslim, we're going to have to take sanctions against you before we start, that's going to be politically unpopular. It would lead certainly to a lot of unrest in Western countries, and political elites, I'm sure, almost to a man, are saying to themselves, well, we really don't want to go down that route because we know it will involve a lot of political unrest, and it'll damage our careers. And what it's far easier to do is to kick the ball into the long grass and hope we can keep the lid on it for the next 15 and 20 years until we're retired, and then it'll be somebody else's problem. And that's an appalling dereliction of duty on behalf of people who should be looking after the indigenous populations and handling things like immigration in a controlled manner, so that when people come into our countries, which have been, you know, relatively stable for decades, decades, if not hundreds of years in the case of some countries, then you're changing the characteristics of that country in a very short period of time with massive immigration from Muslim lands, and if you're not prepared to deal with the consequences, well, you shouldn't be in politics making those decisions. But nevertheless, we are where we are, and we have been subjected to politicians who have made those decisions, and we do have large populations of Muslims who are their behaviour is likely to get worse rather than better as the population grows. And I don't say that because I've got a crystal ball. I'm looking at what happens in every single case where Muslims have grown in population, in amongst the indigenous population, their percentages have increased. And you can almost pinpoint whereabouts the population percentage is by the behaviour of Muslims at any given time. So once they resort to burning cars every night and like they do in many French cities, and starting to do it in places like the Netherlands and Sweden and Norway,
you can
say, oh yeah, they must have got to at least, you know, 10 or 15% before they'll do that, because under that they restrict themselves to I won't say they're paragons of virtue, but you don't see behavior on that scale in countries where the populations are less than 10 or 15%. But once you get above that sort of level, of course, then the behavior becomes more and more lawless, and the rejection of kufar authority becomes more and more obvious, and it becomes much more difficult to police those groups because they do not want to accept kufar authority. And so you get these little enclaves forming, And nobody wants to live in a little enclave where you get antisocial and criminal Muslim behaviour on that sort of scale. So very quickly, those little enclaves become 100% Muslim as everybody else leaves. It's a pattern that you see everywhere. And you would think that the authorities would do everything they could if they were going to take their duties seriously in order to avoid that getting any worse. All right, the very first thing they should do, as Confucius is famously reputed to have said, is when you're in a hole, stop digging. The very first thing we should do is just stop Muslim immigration, absolutely full stop. And we should make it quite clear to the Muslims that are here that if they do not abide by Kufar law absolutely to the letter, then they are going to be disproportionately targeted for sanctions and discrimination. I wrote an article once where I suggested that it would be a good idea to make being criminal while Muslim an aggravating factor rather than the mitigating factor that it is at the moment. I mean, I'm sure we're all familiar with those cases where a Muslim may have indulged in some sort of violence against a non-Muslim. I mean, these cases are quite common, and when they come up against the judge says, well, you're obviously not used to our culture, or you're not used to drinking, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll give them a mitigated sentence on the basis of the fact that they were Muslim. And there was one particular article which I don't have in front of me now, but it was in the UK, and it involved four girls, I believe they were Somalis, and they actually kicked the hell out of a young white girl, pulled her hair out, called her a white bitch.
I remember that.
And the judge said, well, I have to treat you leniently because you're not used to drinking alcohol in your culture. And he let them off without a jail sentence, which I think is absolutely appalling and sends out absolutely the wrong message when we have what is obviously going to be an increasing problem that's going to be more difficult to handle as time goes on. So,
and that's exactly it. But you know what, Tim? I'm really getting sick and tired of the ad hoc responses to these organizations. In this report as well, they refer to the Takfir Walt Hurja ideology in which the Hofstad group was inspired. Now, this is an Islamic group that inspired the ideas of the Hofstad group, and they have been associated with those of the movement of Takfir Walt Hurja. And Takfir meaning infidel, and Hurja meaning flight or leaving. This group finds its origins in Egypt during the 1960s. Its intent was to infiltrate a target society, which would be Islamic or Western, in order to re-Islamize it. Takfir Walt Hurja is Sunni-based and fundamentalist in nature, borrowing on the Salafist ideology, which resembles the Saudi version of Wahhabism. It justifies the use of violence against unbelievers and against perceived renegade Muslims. The Takfir Walt Hurja ideology also condones un-Islamic behavior by its members in order to carry out an armed struggle against Jews and Christians. Now, the idea of the Hostov group are derived from the above and can better be described as neo-Takfir or Takfir light. Takfir light.
Well, I'm smiling at that because I had a little thought to myself earlier this week, and I'm only going to mention this briefly because it's not really the phrase takfir light brings to mind how nice it would be if you could take all the politics out of Islam, and I'm of course. You know, if we could do that and we could call it Islam light, that would be absolutely great. And I actually composed, I'm not going to sing it on air today. I actually composed a little song based on that idea. But I will come back to that maybe later. If I have an extra glass of orange juice, I might sing you that little song. The idea being that the non-Muslim authorities can actually say, "Oh yeah, we can take this ideology and we can develop it as something distinct from Islam and use it to explain away the behavior of some of these Muslims, I think is totally ridiculous. I mean, Islam is what it is, and there is no point trying to trying to justify the behavior of what some of these Muslims are doing by saying, oh yeah, they were influenced by this branch or that branch or whatever. The fact is that Islam as a whole mandates warfare against non-believers for all times and all places. That is a central doctrine of Islam. And you can dress it up whichever way you want, and you can justify individual incidents whichever way you want, but they all come back to Muslims behaving the way they do because of Islamic ideology. And unless we grasp that nettle, we are only going to be making a rod for our own back as the populations in the Western countries grow and the security services run ever-decreasing circles around themselves trying to get to the bottom of more and more of these so-called autonomous networks.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There is so much more in here that we need to dissect, but I was wondering if you want to take a break and maybe refresh your tea and give everybody a chance to do likewise. I had a song right here, and the darn thing ran away from me. Where did you go, you bad boy? Oh, boy, oh, boy. But it's around here somewhere. I'm sure I'll find it. I usually do. Here we go. I found it. I knew I scrolled down a little too far. But there is a lot in this to discuss. There was also another article that we were dissecting, and that was the proposed code of conduct for Muslims. I think that was written up here. I'm just going to go to another page because I have it on another page.
Proposed charter, Kelly?
Yeah, I'm just going to open up a new page and bring that article in because I want to keep the Hofstede page open as well. And that's the proposed code of conduct for British Muslims commissioned by UKIP, MEP Gerard Batten. And we have the full PDF here as well. But there is still so much more about the Hofstede group that we can dissect. But let's take a break, Tim, and we'll see everybody back here in 3.5 minutes.
Okay, good.
And welcome back, everybody. And just to remind you, you are listening to the Red Fox Blogger. I'm your host, Kel Fritzy, and your other host is Tim Burton. We just want to, we have a few programming notes here we want to share with you, but before we do that, we do want to thank everybody who is joining us in the chat room. We want to thank Anna. We want to thank Army of British News, Sarah Bella, Jeff of the English Defense League, Eric Kyle. We have some guests in here, Luchadora, Norway 90, Ken of the Exceptional Conservative, and Vito Esposito just walked in the house. We also want to thank people who are listening online and in other devices, and that includes Sue from New Mexico, my sweet Sue. So everybody, thank you very much for being here. We want to apprise you. As you know, Jeff Mitchell of EDL Radio, he does his show out of England. He is heard here in North America at 3:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. On Sunday morning, our clocks go forward, folks. So Jeff Scholl, you will not get your email alerts, and he will be on 4:30 in the afternoon Eastern Standard Time until the U.K. catches up with us on the 30th of March. So just keep that apprised. If you go to Jeff's show and it's not there, it's because our clocks went forward 3 weeks earlier. So just be aware of that, okay? And I'll be reminding everybody throughout the week. Now, and something else is that, as you know, Tim and myself, we are also the fellow host of the Freedom Loving Infidels heard on Radio Jihad Network here at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 11 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. And our guest tomorrow evening is going to be Paul Sutliff. He is the author who wrote the book, Phase 2, Jihad. And that is targeting Islamic American colleges. My apologies. Stealth Jihad Phase 2, target American colleges. He is also involved with the Brenner Report, so please try to be there for that. It should be a very fascinating discussion that we will have. And Tim, where did he go?
Huh?
There he is.
I'm here.
Hey, Tim.
I'm here.
There you are.
Yes, indeed. Well, thanks for reading all that out, Kel. There's a question in the chat room from Vito saying, what is that in Greenwich Mean Time? But presumably, it's still going to be the same in Greenwich Mean Time, isn't it? It's only that the Eastern Time has changed. Am I right?
Yep, that's right. Our clocks go forward Sunday, March 9th, and your clocks in the UK don't go forward until the 30th. So we're going to be an hour ahead of you in terms of just programming.
Mm. Yeah, okay, that's fine. Just wanted to clarify that for everybody, because it's something I always get confused with as well when the times change. So, yeah, for Greenwich Mean Time listeners, it'll stay the same until March the 30th, but for Eastern Standard Time, well, for American Time listeners, it'll be 1 hour difference.
There you go. We'll just be reminding everybody of that. People in North America in the Eastern Standard Time, when you're used to going to Jeff's place for 3:30 in the afternoon, just keep a note. As of this Sunday, you'll be going there at 4:30 in the afternoon, our time here in North America, or wherever you are. It could be 3 o'clock in the morning, could be 6 o'clock in the morning, it could be 9 o'clock at night. Heck, I don't know. Why do they do this to us, Tim? Why, I say?
Yeah, I know, it's terrible, isn't it? But yes, there we go. Okay, excuse me for chuckling. I just know how confusing it is for these time differences, and it gets even worse for people like Kel, because she's using a watch that I sent over to her, which I took all the springs out of it. I took all the springs out of it before I sent it to her, and she has no end of trouble with it. So yes,
I'm still sending that back. That was the worst Christmas present I ever got.
Well, I could have sent you a pair of socks or a T-shirt or something like that, I suppose. But I thought, no, nothing says, you know, how much I appreciate you than a wonky watch.
Nothing says love like a wonky watch.
Yeah. I think that would be a great advertising slogan.
Oh, I don't know. I might have to get Stanger and we'll have to put something together. But We were talking about the Hofstad organization, Hofstad group. I think a lot of people got a pretty darned good idea as to where we were going with this, and the lack of oversight, in that they're reticent to pay attention and to really crack down on these organizations. They know they're out there, but you're right. What you were saying to him is that, well, you know, they're culturally discombobulated, and they don't know, you know, how to act in a Western society. So, yeah, let's just give them a pass. I mean, they got their little training camps running around out there, but you know what? We'll just arrest them, and, you know, we'll just tell them, you know, we don't do that here. But it's just absolute insanity. And so I think we handled that one quite well. But this other one that you sent to me, actually, and this is a code of conduct for Muslims in Europe. That is a rather interesting proposal.
This is the article that was sent, was devised a while back by Gerard Martin, isn't it, from UKIP?
Yes.
That's the one we're talking about. And the description they've got there is quite interesting in a couple of ways. It's entitled A Proposed Charter of Muslim Understanding, and the idea is to try and to get Muslims to conform much more closely to what we expect in Europe from our citizens. And in many ways it bears a resemblance to the St. Petersburg Declaration, which we discussed a few weeks ago on this very show, wasn't it, Kel? The St. Petersburg Declaration,
which
was
in
2007
right.
In Florida.
That was written, though, by a group of both the apostates and practicing Muslims. This one, though, written by Gerard Batten from the UK Independence Party, this is actually written up by infidels. That's why I found this fascinating.
Yes. Yes. Just to briefly summarize with the St. Petersburg Declaration, the idea was that a group of Muslims and ex-Muslims would get together and provide a template or a framework for the possible reform of Islam so that it would better fit into the 21st century. I suppose the only phrase that comes to mind when I say things like that is good luck with that, because once you try and reform Islam to that sort of extent, well, once you try and reform Islam at all, you reach something which is no longer Islam. And of course, because the Islam itself tells you, or the Quran tells you, that Islam is perfect and doesn't need any reform, any attempts at reform are going to be fraught with difficulty, not to say doomed to failure. So when you want to make grandiose changes of this nature, you have to bear in mind that you are in fact going against the fundamental structure of Islam, and that is going to mean that you're going to have a problem even before you start. But nevertheless, I think it's we both do, Kel and I both think that it's important to bring these kind of proposals to your attention so that you can see A, that there are people out there who are trying to make a difference, no matter how misinformed they may be about the ultimate likelihood of it succeeding. And also, when we go through these particular things, like we did the other week with the St. Petersburg Declaration, as we go through this charter, the proposed Charter of Muslim Understanding, you'll start to see the various characteristics of this charter, which mean that the whole process is fundamentally flawed. And that in itself will give you an idea of the kind of things you can use as discussion topics when you yourselves go out and talk to your friends and colleagues about aspects of Islam. Because, you know, we're not just giving you this evening so that you can fill an hour or two when you haven't got anything better to do. What we're really hoping is that you can take something away from this and say, oh yeah, now I'm a little bit better informed than when I started, and maybe I can I can find an opportunity to explain to, even if it's just one person a week, a little bit about Islam, and hopefully awaken them in some way where they can start to make a difference as well. So hopefully it'll show you a little bit about what that's all about.
Yeah, and Sarah Bella brings up a really good point in the chat room, is that it sounds like the UKIP is still not addressing this. And, of course, Gerard Batten, who is the MP3 for the UKIP, he belonged to the UKIP party, didn't he?
Well, he did indeed, yes. I mean, I'm not sure what position he holds, if he still holds any position in UKIP today. And I think Sarah Bella is quite right. UKIP themselves don't really address the problems with Islam in the way that, say, Liberty GB addresses the problems. UKIP, I'm pretty sure, still suffer from the impression that unless they pander to the Muslim vote, they're not going to get very far in their electoral ambitions. And while that may be true, it doesn't do anything at all for the long-term stability of this country. I think anybody who's interested in long-term stability is going to have to address this at some point. We might have some short-term instability, but the potential for disaster if this is ignored for much longer is going to be absolutely catastrophic.
Now, forgive me if I'm wrong, but I was under the impression that the UKIP party is primarily anti-immigrant.
Well, they're primarily anti-European Union. That was the premise which UKIP was set up when it was formed. I mean, since then, they have refined their policies to a certain extent, and immigration is certainly an issue for many people, and they feel, I suppose, that they will get enough support if they focus on the immigration issue, just as much as if they focus on the European Union issue. But that, certainly that's the way they were set up. But they're not making their anti-Islam aspect a part of their policies for the next election, which I think is a mistake on one level, because we're going to have to address it, and the sooner the better. On the other level, I can understand it if they're looking for numbers in order to get enough support in order to overthrow the three mainstream parties, then yeah, they have to attract a very broad range of people. So it's a case of you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. But that's the nature of our democratic parliamentary system at the moment. Which, all right, there's a lot of faults with it, but that's what we're stuck with at the moment. If they got in and they were able to achieve the goal of getting us out of the European Union, then I would say that would be a price worth paying just to get us out of that. Because at the moment, unless we get ourselves out of the European Union, I'm talking about the UK specifically here, we are going to find it very difficult to implement any policies at all which are going to be anti-Islam or seen as anti-Islam. So the very first thing we have to do is to get out of Europe. So yeah, okay, if UKIP achieves that, then who knows what might be achieved afterwards.
I was reading the introduction of this proposal, and I'm just going to read a little bit of it verbatim, just to give people an idea of what we're dealing with. If Islam is a religion of peace, as portrayed by the Muslim community and its clergy, and those acts of terrorism committed in its name are the acts of a few misguided individuals who have misunderstood and misinterpreted its teaching, then Islam is completely innocent of the violence and the terrorism that is sometimes attributed to it. Now, consequently, in extrapolating from this premise, one should expect that in the light of the current terrorist threat perpetuated by some in the name of Islam, that the faithful ones and the authorized scholars and experts call a general conference of its ulema, the learned scholars of Islamic religion, to discuss provisions such as laid out in this charter, They should have no objection to being signatories to it and upholding its content, both in letter and in spirit, in the name of Islam and for the welfare of their host societies and that of the humanity at large. How many, I wonder if the imams are lining up to sign this charter.
I should think they're queuing up as we speak, Kel. I can just see them there, nudging each other out of the way in the queue. Me first, I want to sign.
Oh, yeah, you know what? Gee, Tim, I bet it was so darn busy. I bet the overflow was so bad that they had to rent a stadium to get to accommodate everybody, get them all in there.
Yeah, that's it. You can just imagine them being whipped back into line. Come on, one at a time, you lot. Yes, that is the problem, isn't it? That we didn't get that kind of support. And in fact, whenever we see suggestions of this nature, it isn't just this particular charter or the St. Petersburg Declaration. It's little things like, why don't we ever see groups of Muslims or respected bodies of Muslims that purport to speak for the Muslim community? Why don't we ever see them coming out and condemning the actions of their co-religionists around the world? Where were the protests, for example, when we had the Chinese Muslims just the other day slaughtering 30 odd people in China and injuring over 100 more? You know, where was the outrage from the Muslim community anywhere in the world? Anywhere? You know, it's just the sound of crickets chirping. And that's the same whenever you have an outrage committed by Muslims, which, by the way, is pretty much every day of the week. Where is the Muslim community ever standing up and saying, we denounce this, it does not represent Islam, and we're going to come on the street and protest it? Yeah, as it says in the chat room, they're too scared. They're too scared to, is one of the comments that's in the chat room. But I think it's not only that they're too scared, is that they don't really believe that such tactics are against Islam, because terror works for Islam very well indeed. If you can create an atmosphere of fear, violence, intimidation and terror, it makes the population much more likely to acquiesce to Islamic demands. I mean, I'm sure we all remember what happened after the Madrid bombings in was that
2005?
Yeah. 3 days after the Madrid bombings, they were due for a Spanish election. And what happened was that the Spaniards were so terrified of the fact that they'd had a major terrorist atrocity at the Madrid train station, that they voted in a candidate who would effectively appease Muslims, because they did not want any more terror in their countries. So as far as Islam is concerned, terror pays very well. And I have to say, when it comes to an ideology that you want to conquer the world through fear, violence, intimidation and terror, you have to say you would be hard put to do for an ideology that is better suited for that than Islam. But if you want an ideology,
Tim,
sorry, go on.
Oh, no, I'm going to let you finish your sentence, because I'm getting ready to desk pound.
Okay. But what I'm saying is that if you want an ideology that allows you to live in peace with your fellow man in perpetuity as equals, and upholding the principles of freedom of speech and freedom of religion and equality of everybody before the law, then you do not want Islam in any way, shape or form, and it should be outlawed, reassigned a category as a political ideology and driven to the margins of society. That's what should happen. But if you, I mean, if all you wanted to do was just conquer the world and kill anybody that got in your way, then that's what I'm saying about Islam. In the 7th century, it was the ideal thing to have an ideology that would do that if you wanted to conquer the world, starting with Arabia and working outwards. It actually worked very well. But what we want now is not to do that. We don't want that kind of ideology anywhere on our planet, thank you very much. And we have to recognise that as a political ideology, it has no place in the 21st century at all. So that
before you
desk pound, that's why I wanted to finish what I was saying. Now, pound away.
Oh, okay. Well, no, just as a sidebar, I just want to clear up something. The Madrid train bombings, they took place on the morning of the 11th of March in 2004, and it's also referred to as Spain 11M. So just wanted
2004.
To...
2004. Okay. My apologies. I thought it was 2005. Okay, fine.
No, I thought it was 2005 as well. This is why I love Google. Google is my best friend, believe me. It makes me look a lot smarter than I actually am, but will never be half as smart as you, Tim, either way. But just reading
you
this, like. You know, reading this proposed charter, I'm terrible. A proposed charter on Muslim understanding, and I had been going through the articles, and I don't know what they're hoping to accomplish with this. I mean, yes, they do want signatories on this, but Article 1, for example, right off the top of, we will respect all other non-Muslim religions in word and deed by issuing a clear fatwa with an immediate effect prohibiting the use of force and violence of any kind against followers of any or all non-Muslim religions. The issue of threats through any religious fatwas threatening with violence against institutions or assassination of individuals or groups and followers of other religions who may be domiciled in the affected localities or any other country, be it a Muslim majority or otherwise. Okay, that's Article 1, and we move into Article 2. We will respect and honor all civilizations, cultures, and traditions, and all other nations and people, irrespective of their ethnic or religious backgrounds. Let me see. We go into Article 3. In the spirit of the saying, that there be no compulsion in religion, that's Surah chapter 2, verse 256, we commit to the upholding the value of freedom, and in particular freedom in belief and expression. Okay, we move Article 4, Article 5. There are so many articles in here. One I'm going to get to in a moment. I'm going to make my bullet point. I'm going to pass the mic back to Tim because I do have a real issue with another article here, but I'm going to save that for a moment because that's pretty much a standalone conversation right there. But Tim, I don't know what they're hoping to accomplish with this. Is this almost like what Canada is trying to do in the sense is that we revised our immigration handbook and that it was specifically designed towards Muslims, that you would virtually sign a contract that you would uphold Canadian values and Canadian laws. Is this required reading for Muslims entering Western countries? Is this what they're proposing?
Well, I think if it was what they're saying, you could understand why there's problems with it. You've only gone through the first few articles that are there. And already I see a huge flaw. Yeah, I'm sure some of our listeners see a huge flaw as well, in as much as that if you were to implement the it's like reducing the Quran to an instruction handbook for a commercial organisation, and you can just say to new converts, well, we used to do it this way, but now we're going to take out all the nasty, violent passengers, and we're just going to do it this way, so that your organisation, your semi quasi commercial organisation, Islam, now conforms to the new improved handbook. And it just isn't going to work because, of course, the Quran says at more than one point, I think it says that Islam is the perfect religion. Muhammad is the perfect example for mankind. That's Quran chapter 33, verse 21. And that anybody who tries to make changes will be guilty of, I forget what the word is, but it will effectively make them an apostate and liable for beheading or otherwise slaughtering in the most cruel manner you can imagine. And anybody who questions Islam in any way there'll be various divine punishments. I think that's Quran chapter 5, verse 101 and verse 102. So once you've got those things in the Quran, which basically says that Islam must not and cannot be reformed, when you bring in a proposed charter of Muslim understanding like this, it is obviously not going to be accepted by anybody who calls themselves a devout Muslim. It might look perfectly reasonable on the face of it to us non-Muslims, especially non-Muslims who have no idea about Islam and who've only ever been told about Islam by a well-meaning Muslim who, of course, never tells them the truth, because Muslims will never tell you the truth about Islam, because that's all part and parcel of the lies and deceit that make up the relationship between Muslims and non-Muslims. So a non-Muslim who's uninformed, in fact, only a non-Muslim who is completely uninformed, would even think about bringing in a charter of Muslim understanding along these lines, because the changes that are required are never going to be accepted by anybody who calls themselves a devout Muslim.
Mm-hmm. You know, the chat room is quite busy in there, and they're talking back and forth. And I also want to thank No Way and Dodgy Dave and Eric Kyle for joining us. But this is pretty bad, Tim. This is pretty bad that when we have to sign a charter asking people, if you come here, please don't kill us, please don't blow us up. Like,
well, yeah, it is. I mean, in practical terms, you know, wouldn't it be nice if every Muslim who came in had to sign a charter of this nature, and they said, oh yes, we'll drop all pretense of trying to kill you when your back's turned, and you know, if we get, just because we reproduce like rabbits, when we get to a certain percentage of the population, we won't make your lives hell. Wouldn't it be nice? But unfortunately, it's just never going to happen because of the nature of Islam, and Islam cannot be altered or reformed by non-Muslim dictates, even if it's in a well-meaning proposed charter of Muslim understanding like this is. That it just takes no account of the nature of Islam and its unreformability, and that's Cerebella says. Cerebella says they must be laughing in their lice-infested beards, which I think is wrong.
Oh, Cerebella, yeah. they're lice-infested henna-dyed beards, don't you know?
Yep, henna-dyed.
But this Article 6, and when I was speaking with Tim about this, he knew that I was quite animated about this, and thus the, you know, the truncheon comes out sometimes, but Article 6, it just drove me nuts, this one. Based on the acceptance of equality of all mankind, brotherhood of all, and the freedom and sanctity of all human life, and based on the principle that, quote, whoever slays one man is as though he has slain the whole of humanity, unquote. All acts of terrorism are prohibited, shunned, and outlawed. A, no suicidal mission undertaken for whatever reason. It is not justified. B, no violent physical jihad operation will be regarded as sacred. And C, no one who chooses to die in such an operation will be regarded as a martyr. Now, Tim knows why I have an issue with this Article 6, and in particular with that quote that they took from the Quran, and we know that as chapter 5, verse 35. Verse 32, they lied by omission right there, and that they did not include. This is claptrap.
Well, it is, because, of course, chapter 5, as you say, includes the phrase, chapter 5, verse 32, includes the phrase, whosoever slays one man, it's as though he has slain the whole of humanity. And that all sounds really great, and a lot of our Western leaders have quoted that just as an example to show how peaceful and advanced and well-meaning Islam is, in the same way that they quote chapter 2, 256, where it says there shall be no compulsion in religion. And of course, it is dissimulation, it's lying by omission, because of course the very next verse after chapter 5 verse 32, which is chapter 5 verse 33, refers to those who make mischief in the land, and they will be subject to various horrible punishments, such as the cutting off of alternate hands and feet and so on. The goodness that you might detect in chapter 5 verse 32 is completely outweighed by the context in which that verse is set, insofar as it tells Muslims to behave with restraint and with goodwill towards other Muslims. But when it comes to people making mischief in the land, and it's obvious that they're talking about Jews and Christians and other non-Muslims in that verse, then the most dire punishments are permissible. And the dichotomy that exists there is something that's never talked about by our political elites. They say Islam is a religion of peace, it commands Muslims to be good to one another, and indeed it does. Islam does command Muslims to be good to one another, but that does not include non-Muslims. That is only Muslims to be good to other Muslims. When it comes to non-Muslims, Muslims are required to be ruthless and to strike at their necks and their fingertips. And there are, I think, well over 100 verses in the Quran which directly command violence towards non-believers. And
I think there's 107.
I was going to say 109, but I mean, there's a lot. That's the point. And our political leaders do not refer to any of those when they're trying to convince us how benign and tolerant and peaceful the Quran is, and by extension, how Islam is. They don't refer to all that, and it's a complete deceit. And What can I say? That's the main thing about Article 6, of course, that it completely ignores all the implications of the preceding and following verses.
Oh, yeah. I was looking into this Quran 532, and it moved me, of course, into 533 and 534. When that verse was written, and of course it was not put in full context, and this was actually written directed towards the children of Israel, i.e. the Jews, who according to Islam received an earlier set of scriptures, but it's mistakenly referencing a rabbinical commentary found in the Talmud, as if it were the words of God. So, again, they're lying to us.
What a surprise.
They can't get their story straight. They can't even get their own bloody story straight. They're trying to sell us a bill of goods, and they're like, oh, well, hang on a minute. Hang on. Hold on. Wait a minute. Okay, hang on. It's just, so that really bothered me. Article 6 just really ticked me off. And when I was Skyping with Tim and we were going over our show notes, I was kind of like spitting nails over this one. But all the same, as an overview in this charter, it is really sad. It's pathetic that people sit around and actually sit down and write this stuff out because it's needed in the West. Want this to be global, but just getting back, and I made a funny about all the imams and all the adherents who are going to line up and sign this and sign this charter. I don't. It's not going to happen. I don't even know why we even bother trying to tie ourselves up in pretzels to come out with these nonsensical charters, because they are ineffective. They're not going to be adhered to. We know that. So what's the point? I think the point is that what you said, Tim, just stop all – well, first of all, we stop Islamic immigration, but we get draconian. Now, I brought up the issue a little while back about internment camps. That's never going to happen. But what we can do is, as you say, Tim, stop, an immediate moratorium on Islamic immigration into Western countries. And two, when I was speaking with Bonnie of Bare Naked Islam a little while back, and she said, well, you were speaking with her too, Tim. And
yes,
she
yes.
said to us that make it as comfortable as possible for them to want to leave the West. Get the money to set up a shop in the Middle East or wherever, Pakistan, wherever they want to go. Get the money, put them, give them a first-class ticket, and just get them out.
Well, yes, and the reasoning behind that is that it will be far, far cheaper to do that in terms
yes.
of not only money, but lives and misery and the destruction of our society, which will result if we don't do it. So it was something I'm reminded very much about what somebody said to me when I was first starting up in business years ago. And I was complaining at the time about the cost of actually educating my employees so that they did their job correctly. And somebody who'd been in that line of business longer than I had said to me, "You think educating them is expensive? Try the cost of ignorance and set that against the cost of educating them." And it's no different.
Very good.
Insofar as you think it's expensive, giving them a ticket or an airline ticket and setting them up abroad, try looking at the cost of what will be the cost if we don't do that, and it will probably be 10 times, if not 100 times higher in terms of the destruction and mayhem that they will cause if they continue to grow in the way that they have up to the present day. So, yeah, I think it's actually a very good idea of Bonnie's to seriously consider making it very, very easy for them to move back to the Middle East. And certainly anybody who's come over here and who is not yet a citizen would say, fine, don't even think about becoming a citizen. You know, we'll set you up in Islamabad or Peshawar or Jordan or Amman in Jordan or wherever you would like to go in the Middle East. We'll set you up with enough money to, you know, make a living over there, and we'll ship you and your family over there, and wish you well. But if we don't do something along those lines, we are going to be in for a world of pain, without a doubt.
And just reading down, we haven't covered a lot of the articles. People get an idea, though, and there you go. I just put the link in the chat room. Maybe what I'll do is what I should have done when I was setting up the show. I should have put the links in the show highlights proper for people to go there later on and archive and take a listen. But maybe I'll do that before I close out the show. But Article 8, before we close out the show, Kel, not only your show, Kel. Stop it. Stop that.
Don't have to take the truncheon
to myself.
Don't worry.
But yeah, Article 8. And that we will foster a better relationship with non-Muslims and promote peace by issuing regular fatwas promoting peace and brotherhood between Muslims and non-Muslims as a foundational teaching of Islam. Okay, that's very well and fine. That's fantastic. It would be wonderful if that was actually what was being taught, but it's not being taught. It won't be taught. It never will be taught. And an issue I have with that is, as an infidel, what if I don't want to get along with Muslims? Why should I have to put up with Muslims in my country? I know that they're not going to adhere to this charter. I know that for a fact. I am, when it comes to Islam with me, Tim, I'm always in the mind that I'm always waiting for the other shoe to drop, because that friendly Muslim, he is a fantastic guy. I love his corner store. Well, you know I don't, because I've probably never been in it, but I'm sure he's a very fine fella, a great coworker, and a community involved, and that's very well and fine. But when it comes to Muslims, I'm always waiting for the other shoe to drop. I don't know if I want to incorporate and intermingle with this with Islam living next door to me.
Well, what you have to remember, of course, is that the Muslim who's living next door and who's smiling and friendly, and his children, you know, may go to the same school as yours, and everything may seem fine. What happens? The question is to ask, what happens when jihad comes to town, as it has across the world in so many places? Where will that Muslim stand? And the answer is that he will more than likely stand with his co-religionists against you as a non-Muslim. And it won't just be a question of he'll disinvite himself from coming round to your tea party. It'll be a case he'll be getting out the kitchen knives and the machetes, and it will be Allah Akbar all over your ass, as they like to say in some parts of the world.
I guess I just have trust issues.
Well, and quite right too, because let's not forget that you have to go right back to what Islam really is in terms of its doctrine mandating eternal warfare against non-believers, and the taqiyya, the tariya, the kitman, and the maruna, the various forms of deception that Muslims employ against non-Muslims in every aspect of their dealing with non-Muslims. It would be surprising if there weren't trust issues, because Muslims simply cannot be trusted to deal as equals in perpetuity with non-Muslims without looking for the opportunity to get one over on them. And when it might be all right, perhaps you might get cheated in business, or there might be some minor civilizational issue that, you know, doesn't actually cause you any physical harm but just irks you slightly, that might, if that's the worst thing that happens to you in your experience with Muslims, well, okay, that's not so bad, because there are plenty of non-Muslims who might do the same thing. But when jihad comes to town, you're going to have to watch out, because the chances are that a significant, if not to say an outright majority of Muslims will side with their co-religionists and slaughter you if the opportunity arises. And for those people who say that could never happen here in my neighborhood, you just got to look at what the Christians in various parts of the Middle East, and most recently in Syria, they probably thought exactly the same as you. They thought that their neighbors could be trusted right up to the point where jihad came to town, and then they found that they couldn't trust their Muslim neighbors at all, and their Muslim neighbors were joining with the people who were slaughtering them.
It's something that we can't bank on. I want to speak with you in particular and get a little personal with you here, Tim. And that, there's also a lot of people in the chat room hailing from the UK joining us today. And when you see what's going on about you in your own country, do you draw parallels to any other country in the West, or do you think that, in particular, is North America, like, we know we're behind, but when you see what's happening, and I asked Sonny this, and I asked Tommy this, the young folks, 20 years down the road, what can we expect if Islam goes unfettered? Because obviously benign articles like this, which is probably taxpayer-funded, by the way, people, this proposed charter of Muslim understanding, I see this going nowhere fast.
As you say, the articles like this will go nowhere fast. I mean, that was written in 2007, and coincidentally, the same year as the St. Petersburg Declaration was made. And at that time, we're only going back 7 years, but there were both Muslims and non-Muslims there who at that time, 7 years ago, who recognised, yeah, there was a problem, but maybe it could be overcome by reforming Islam in this way. But I think 7 years on, we are starting to realise that it's a non-starter. Well, first of all, having put those proposals out into the public space, we've had 7 years and we're looking at the complete disinterest of any and all Muslims in the proposed charter that we've been talking about, and in the St. Petersburg Declaration. There's been virtually zero interest from mainstream Muslim groups in either of these things. So naturally, people might have said, well, in the first week after they released those articles, they might have thought, oh, well, maybe not everybody's seen them yet. We haven't had people beating a path to our door, but give it time. You know, 2 weeks, 2 weeks goes by, 3 months goes by, 6 months goes by, and still nobody's turned up from the Muslim community to say what a great idea this is. So after 7 years, I think we're entitled to say, okay, we get the message. You are not interested in reforming Islam in any meaningful way. You are not interested in dropping the political nature of Islam in order for Muslims to integrate into our Western communities very well, we have to take the appropriate steps to defend ourselves. And yes, when it comes to America, you could say that things are not quite as far advanced there as they are here. But of course, over here, all we have to do is to look at other countries that have had increasing Muslim populations in living memory. The one I often like to refer to is Lebanon, because it has a lot of parallels. Lebanon was a very, very cosmopolitan society, very westernized, largely it was majority Christian only two generations ago. Then they opened their doors to Muslims from neighboring countries. Within 10 years, 15 years, they were embroiled in a civil war. Now that civil war lasted over 20 years, and we're still looking at a very, very hostile environment for Christians in Lebanon now. Most of the Christians there have fled. There is only a very small Christian presence in Lebanon now, and it's majority Muslim. And that is where I would see this country going in 15 or 20 years, believe it or not, as little as that. If our politicians do nothing, if Muslim demographics proceed along the lines that they have been proceeding, unrestrained and unchecked, if we get Turkey joining the European Union, which means unfettered access to the UK for Turkish nationals, and there's 100 million of them, and we're only a little country of about 50 or 60 million people at the moment, and if half the Turks from Turkey who decide it would be a good idea to come over to the UK and start up a kebab shop, if they come over here, we are going to be vastly outnumbered in a very short period of time, and our parliamentary democratic system means that if we get a majority of Muslims in this country and they start to implement Muslim-friendly laws, you can bet your bottom dollar that it's going to be detrimental to any non-Muslim that happens to be living here. Do we want our countries to go the way of Lebanon and ultimately Syria? I suggest we do not. And if we do not, we are going to have to take action now. And sooner or later, you are going to be faced with the same thing in the United States and Canada. It may take longer because the percentages that you're currently at are smaller. But what you've got to remember with things like demographics is that if you've got say 0.1% this year and it doubles to 0.2% the next year, that's not a big deal. If you've got 1% this year and it doubles to 2% next year, okay, it's not as good, but it's not the end of the world. If you've got 5% this year and it doubles to 10% next year, you've got a major problem on your hand because of the way that the paradigm of population increase changes when Muslims become 10% of the population. You start to see major social unrest that you don't see when they're 0.1% or 0.2%. And so in a very short period of time, when the population of Muslims increases in the way that it does, because of course Muslim families have typically 4 to 5 children, whereas non-Muslim families have typically 1.5 to 2 children, that is actually a huge difference over a comparatively short period of time, and you will find that the society will become transformed a lot quicker than you think. Of course, history can take unexpected turns, and it doesn't necessarily have to be as bad as I am suggesting. But nevertheless, the writing is on the wall, and we are going to have to do something about it sooner or later.
Yeah, and we absolutely are. And with that, we are right out of time. But, Tim, I think that we gave the listeners more homework for the week, and we want to see you back here Monday at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and we want the reports on our desks, please.
Yep, that's it. We'll be asking questions, and anybody who can't answer them will be put on the naughty step. So, yes.
That's right. They'll be written up.
We will write you up, definitely.
And also just to remind people that you can hear Tim and myself again tomorrow night at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where we are the Freedom Loving Infidels on Radio Jihad Network. And just to remind people, our boss, Vito Esposito, is gracing our chat room. Vito has his program coming up in a little over an hour at the Radio Jihad Network, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, so please join Vito there for that. You know I'll be there. I'm getting there early because I like getting the front row seat when I go to Vito's place. That is one hot show.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, Tim, again, a blast. It was fantastic.
Yeah, it was good. It was good. And I'm very pleased we were actually able to cover the topics that we did in the extent that we did in the time that we had. It's always a challenge when you've got a two-hour show. Sometimes, you know, you start a show off and you think, oh, 2 hours is all the time in the world. But when you've got topics like this, the time really does shoot past. So thank you for that, Kel. It was a wonderful, wonderful show.
And ladies and gentlemen, on that note, Tim and myself, we're going to say goodbye for another week, but we won't be saying goodbye for too long. We'll be here Monday, of course, but we'll see you tomorrow night as well. Ladies and gentlemen, we want to thank you so very much for joining Tim and myself in that we covered some pretty heavy-duty topics. We got the links in the chat room. I hope that you can explore them and read for yourself, come to your own conclusions. But one thing I can tell you, and Tim can tell you, that is absolute craziness out there. It is mass Islamity, and we have to stop the insanity. On that note, Tim, have a great evening.
Yes, you too, Kel. I'll speak to you soon.
You bet.
Keep hope alive.
I know sometimes in life you feel that everything is lost, and that mountain is just too high to climb.
Keep hope.
Well, that's when you gotta dig deep down inside and reach that inner strength you never knew you had to give you the will to carry on another day. And all the day goes by and you're outside still wondering why, watching everything you work so hard, and life all begins to fall apart. It breaks your heart to see it all crumbling at the wayside. You wanna lay your head down, pack it in and say goodbye, cause there's nothing left here to keep hope alive. Until you see the only two things in life that really matter, it's a little girl and a little boy. Won't you fool this pride, won't you beautiful